There should be more founders out there. We need more people starting businesses to solve all the problems that we're facing as a society. And if we can play a small part in leveling the playing field, I guess, in terms of how capital gets allocated to founders and giving some power back to retail investors in that decision-making as to where capital goes, then I'd be very proud of that.
Hey everyone, I'm here with Kirsty Grant, Managing Director at Seeders, Europe's leading private investing platform. Under her leadership, Seeders has become the most active investor in early stage private companies in the UK, funding over 2,000 deals and participating in rounds totaling over £2.6 billion to date. This year, she played an instrumental role in launching Seeders EU regulated entity. During this episode, we discussed the past and future of crowdfunding, how companies like Revolut and investors like Seedcam used Seeders to raise funds, and why we need more founders in Europe. Enjoy.
Last year, we were acquired by Republic, the US platform. And so globally now, as part of Republic, I think we are 300 people-ish. And within the Seeders, so that covers UK and Europe, we're around about 100.
Tell me, because I went on your profile and I just saw that you were practicing law for about 10 years. That's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
And I was wondering, like, what drove you to the world of investing in startups?
Yeah. Look, people often ask that, and I always get aspersions suggesting that, you know, lawyers can't be entrepreneurial and can't take risks. But I sort of feel like I've earned my stripes after sort of 10 years of corporate practice in private practice law firms. You know, the last one I was at was Freshfields here in London. To make the jump from that into a pre-Series A startup that was 20 people in a room in Shoreditch, I feel like, you know, I could be a risk taker too. Look, it was, but there was push and pull factors really. I mean, I was an M&A lawyer. I enjoyed so many aspects of that. I enjoyed getting to know businesses. You know, you have these very intense periods where you have to get to know a business, you have to diligence it, but you also, if you're a good lawyer, you kind of need to know the market in which your client operates, the drivers for the transaction, which particularly in sort of trade sales and private M&A, is usually driven by the sort of competitive dynamics of the market. So I always found all of that side of things interesting, and I liked deals. I liked getting the deal done. I liked the negotiation. Some of it's performative, but I enjoy seeing that part of it as well. But what I didn't like, I guess, was sort of law firm culture and dynamics. It's incredibly hierarchical, you know, internally very slow moving, even if your clients are doing exciting things. And so, Seeders, the opportunity came sort of just at the right time, really, and was just the sort of perfect antidote and perfect fit for those skills, because so much of what we do is still about that kind of legal structuring, putting a deal together, you know, getting the deal done. And that was certainly the bulk of my role when I first joined Seeders. But getting to do that in a innovative environment, fast-paced, where you are, you know, working with companies that are delivering innovative products, moving things forward, and it just felt like I was finally able to create real value rather than just sort of move it around the same bucket.
And I'm curious, what was Seeders' team pitch to you? Because here you are, you have 10 years of experience, super talented. Assume that you had some doubts in joining a pre-Series A startup. You're like quite in the beginning. What was their pitch to you?
You know, I don't think I really understood how big a risk I was taking at the time. You know, now looking back, I think that was probably a pretty crazy thing to do. But it was one of those things, I didn't know that they had to pitch it that hard, because it just, the whole idea made sense to me. You know, I was surrounded by tech engineers, people who had joined startups. I had those friends who were in that world, and we would always discuss, wouldn't it be really cool if, you know, you could invest, you know, find these types of opportunities and invest in them on a platform somewhere. But we would always sort of run into the problems of how do you do that? How do you do it without, you know, making it, you know, regulatory compliant? How do you do it without getting arrested, essentially? How do you do it in a way that works for the founder and the investor? And all of those sort of problems that we grappled with, when I sort of saw what Jeff and Carlos had built, I was like just sort of a little bit blown away, like they had solved it all. And it was you know, very early days, but even when I joined, there was a product, there was a site that you could go to. It wasn't perhaps as slick as it looks now, but you could go and test it out. I went in and I invested, and I think I invested in Cedars first, which is a little bit embarrassing actually, but it was just the thing I was looking for, I think, in terms of that next step. I do remember that when I came for my interview, the guy that was interviewing me at the time met me at the door of the office and said, let's go get a coffee, and wouldn't let me actually look into the office because it was a tiny little room. And I think when I joined, I was sort of the last desk sort of shoved in there before we were able to sort of secure funding and find a proper place that fit us all.
You've been with Cedars for almost 9 years now. What are the transformations that you have seen also with Cedars, but also in the overall crowdfunding environment?
I always think about it in kind of three key phases. Never that neat, of course, but there's sort of three key trends I've seen, and our product has sort of followed those trends somewhat. The first one was really that launch phase. And, you know, I kind of call that almost like the peer-to-peer phase, because the way Cedars was launched was coming out of the financial crisis. There were all these fintechs in London. We all know this sort of story, you know, did really well off the back of, you know, consumer disenchantment with sort of financial service, the incumbent providers of financial services, did a great job of unbundling services and using technology to make them more customer friendly, more accessible. And you saw, you know, the Revoluts, Monzo, Starling, et cetera, all those sort of neobanks launch. And then you saw, you know, a lot of peer-to-peer platforms crop up as well. First in the debt space, you know, really that peer-to-peer lending piece. And Cedars sort of launched off the back of that, and equity crowdfunding came to the fore off the back of that wave, and was in those early days often lumped in with that peer-to-peer space and spoken about as if it was a peer-to-peer platform, which I think made sense at the time because it was often very early stage companies. So a founder really kind of going out there and raising from their peers, you know, it was often small networks of investors that they knew. And what we were really providing was transaction capabilities to aggregate those smaller investors, you know, make it more convenient, make it work as a one legal structure for the founder. But then in the next phase, and what sort of brought broader understanding and awareness was where it was really realized that the power of crowdfunding had as a community engagement tool. And that became understood and adopted en masse, particularly by some of those B2B startups and in the fintech space that I mentioned before. They were at that point, I guess, scaling up, growing their customer bases and coming up to their Series B and Series C funding rounds. And a lot of them intuitively understood the power of bringing their customers in as investors. They didn't necessarily need to turn to crowdfunding as a source of capital. And in those sorts of scenarios, we were often sort of playing a part as an allocation in a Series B, a Series C, even, you know, a Series D funding rounds in the likes of Revolut, Plum, Lambay. And they would sort of carve out that allocation for their community. And that brought, you know, so much of more awareness to the product. The sort of third evolution is really now, and now it's sort of really an equity marketplace. We've seen much broader ecosystem adoption. Where the product has gone to follow that is quite interesting. So, like, first we launched our secondary market, which brought newfound liquidity to this asset class that you really wouldn't have before. Brought a new sort of more sophisticated investor in, I think, who's sort of looking at this as a key part of their portfolio and as a financial product. And then more recently, we've been doing a lot of work with venture funds. So we're now raising capital for VCs who are making allocations in their funds available to often their network of founders from earlier funds, or that just their audience more broadly. And then that just does so much to sort of deepen the type of people that are using the platform, the types of capital that is exchanging hands through the platform. We sort of started that with Seedcamp. We've worked with Passion Capital now, and, you know, Zinc, Hamburg Perks this year. And now we're talking to a lot of those funds about how we help them develop the right vehicle for them to do co-investments, for them to syndicate certain deals and bring their portfolio back to the platform to make use of the network effect that they've already created for their fund.
Interesting. So if I understand this correctly, there are like two sides of it, where on one side you have the infrastructure, like the pipelines, the legal that you need to do the formation of capital and to invest either into a startup or an investor. But also like the second, maybe you also have the community part of it, whereas like maybe in the beginning you will have your consumers that would want to invest and you can go on Seeders and they can invest. But then also you can have like a broader community of investors that can invest. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah. I think that's a really good way of explaining it. If you think about the infrastructure piece and the transaction capability that's there and can be used to, you know, do angel networks and syndicates and all those things that we sort of do behind the scenes. Whereas I think the thing that you see, that you usually see about Seeders and that we're more known for is that big pool of investors, the big pool of capital that is there engaging with these products. But yeah, it's sort of bringing together both those sides and again, the big pipeline of founders coming through as well.
It's very interesting if you think about the first formations of capital within venture capital from 1970, where VCs will take like 80% and the transaction would be very much focused in one-to-one, whereas like the formation of capital now is kind of changing. For an entrepreneur listening, how would they go about to list on Seeders, or how would you call it? Would they go there to list? Would they go there to search for funds? Would they go there to attract both their community that they have already, but also to have access to a broader community?
As you say, there's this sort of fragmentation of how capital is pooled, where to find it, as more and more choices available. We're trying to do a good job at making it simple for them and providing all of the potential options. So, you know, at its most basic, if they're just looking for capital, yes, we kind of call it, they would list, they would sort of come and work with us to sort of get a campaign together, and we would work with them on what the best option is for them at that point. You know, is it just a private deal where they want to bring in their own network? What are the marketing strategies that we can help them with to really engage their customers and make them part of the company, invested in financially, but also sort of invested in the success and future of that business? And then, you know, finally, you know, what more can we do once they're in the portfolio to help them on that journey, whether it be, you know, introducing to that institutional capital, providing liquidity to them, their employees, some of their existing shareholders via our secondary market, you know, just trying to provide all aspects of services, I guess, that go on that fundraising journey for our founders.
Got it. So that means that you serve both, like, what's the earliest entrepreneurs that you can serve? I'd say pre-seed, seed, and then also you can serve Series C, Series D that try to get access on the secondary.
Yeah, absolutely. We really are stage agnostic. You know, we do SEIS deals still. With the smaller deals, it's always just a matter of, you know, talking realistically with founders about where is that capital going to come from? You know, will our investor pool be interested, understand what the proposition is? Is it far enough along for them to take that risk? Or is this more about engaging the network of the founder itself, him or herself? And then quite rightly, you know, we go on to Series A, Series B, and on through the alphabet, all the way up to, you know, we have raised for listed companies now. Chapel Down, for example, listed on Aquis, and they have done private placement raises through us with the shares then listed on the exchange. So fairly long journey that we go on with our founders now. You always think that we're going to get them out of the portfolio on an IPO, and it seems that we're still sticking around.
Is there a way to prepare for a successful listing?
Absolutely there is. Yes, yes. And that is, you know, where we spend a significant portion of our time is working with founders to make sure that they are going to have a successful listing and that it's going to achieve the aims that they have for that campaign listing. As we've sort of touched on, it's not always just about the capital. That's obviously a really key part of it, and we're not doing our jobs unless we're providing that. But we will talk them through all of the strategies to make sure it aligns with their objectives. From a founder themselves, you know, what I always say, like we are sector agnostic, stage agnostic. What I really need a founder to be ready for is to you know, accept a wide group of shareholders into their company, and they should be realistic about what that means and ready to make the most of the benefits of that as well. And so we don't, you know, it's not about becoming a public company. That's not what we're here to do. But, you know, they need to be ready to communicate with their audience, provide a certain level of transparency, and invest themselves in that relationship, I guess, with their shareholders and their investors, so that it has the benefits that they have come to this model of crowdfunding for.
More specifically, what does that entail, let's say, on a monthly, quarterly basis?
I mean, in terms of getting ready for a campaign, we always say it's sort of like a six-week process to be ready to launch. A lot of that is, you know, us doing our due diligence on the company, ensuring it is right for our investor base, but then equally working with the founder on what is the outreach strategy, testing demand. So we spend a lot of time using various tools to test what we think the demand will be from our investors and from their community to make sure it is worth their while to proceed. And then say 1 month sort of fundraising period. So sort of end to end, let's call it 3 months to get money into the bank. Post fundraise, so post completion of that, we're just asking entrepreneurs to keep their investors up to date on a sort of quarterly basis. We don't prescribe the format of that. Founders tend to communicate during the fundraise about what they're going to provide to shareholders on an ongoing basis. And then it's really about, you know, making the most of that huge audience that you then have. So, you know, the updating, the kind of reporting is one piece, but more, you know, what have you got interesting that's going on? What product launches are coming up that you want your shareholders to know about and engage with? And the most successful companies at building a community do that piece really well. You know, they come back and use their audience as beta testers for products. They have them vote for them when they're up for awards. You know, they ask them feedback on various aspects. And also often use them as like recruitment tools. You see them sort of posting that they're looking for a CFO, they need a new head of sales, does anyone have any recommendations? It's a two-way relationship, and I think those that treat it that way, you know, make the most of it.
Could you give us a sense in terms of volume? Like how many startups do you have per month or per quarter? How do you measure that? And also what is your goal?
Yeah, so our goal is always measured in both number of deals and investment volumes. And then with various other products like the secondary market, operates in a slightly different way. And then investor returns, of course, as well. So in terms of volume, we are doing probably completing around 300 deals a year these days. And that's stayed relatively steady the last few years, although deal size has tended to increase. And then on the investor returns piece, we're the only platform to have published a portfolio report that goes through the data on investor returns. I think in the last one, the overall portfolio IRR was around about 10%. I need to dig it out, but we're intending to launch a new report this year, where we haven't launched one in the last 2 years, but we should have one out before this year end, I believe. Generally speaking, you know, we're returning profits to investors back via the secondary market on a month-on-month basis, and also seeing, I think we're up to about 50 exits from the portfolio now.
It's uncommon that you all showed the return on investment, because you could argue that it's not your job, it's the investor's job to go and to find a deal and to invest in a deal. But then you kind of took a little bit of ownership to show, look, we're doing the due diligence, we're making sure that these are good companies that you can invest. So you kind of take a little bit of that ownership if you publish the number.
Yeah, you touched on a really interesting point. It's a debate that we have internally all the time. Like, what is our role exactly as a marketplace, really? Are we intending to pick the right companies for the marketplace? Are we an open marketplace where provided you pass, you know, the basic due diligence that, you know, you have to do a certain amount of checks to ensure it's, you know, above board. But beyond that, is it entirely up to the investor then to make their own investment decision? And, it's something we go back and forward on. What we now do is we publish our due diligence process and report as well. So that was, I guess, where we landed. And where we got to was, well, we don't know the investment thesis of every investor on our platform, and we cannot possibly know their investment thesis or what they're looking for, right? So what can we do is we can tell them, you know, this is our DD process, this is what we have done, and, you know, this is where we stop. And therefore, you know, these are the gaps that you need to fill in if that's part of what you're looking for in a business. So that's the approach we've taken. We are really selective. You know, we have probably less than 10%, I think it is, of companies that apply to raise with seeders make it onto the platform. So, you know, we aren't necessarily selective about the businesses that we put in front of investors, but equally, you know, we don't want to be the gatekeeper as such of that capital. We do want a sort of fair playing field to an extent to allow founders to have that go, to find the kind of community of investors that believe in their business model, that identify with their product, and to have that chance to receive investment from them and hopefully be a great success.
Are there any specific sectors that do well on your platform? I know that you mentioned that you're sector agnostic.
Yeah, we are. And no single sector makes up more than about 10% of the portfolio. But there are certain areas where we are stronger for sure. This year, the standout sector has really been climate tech. And it probably comes as no surprise if you're, no. speaking to people in the venture space this year. It's been one of the few bright spots, along with generative AI, I guess, in terms of receiving venture capital this year. We have seen a huge surge of interest from our investors into this space, and our recent investor survey said that that was sort of the number one sector that they wanted to see more opportunities from. So we saw the likes of Green Lithium raised over 4 million from sort of over 3,000 investors earlier this year. We've got Heliac raising at the moment, a Danish company which provides high efficiency green solar thermal solutions. So that's been certainly the fastest growing sector. I mentioned fintech earlier as well. You know, we have come out of that, as I was saying, it's a sort of a natural fit. We've come out of that wave of fintechs in London, and customers of fintechs tend to be great investors as well. You know, they are early adopters. They're comfortable with using technology for financial products. And so it just is a natural good fit for crowdfunding. This year, I think Yondr was one of the biggest fintech raises we saw across all platforms, actually, with 13 million for their credit card for adventurers, so-called. But yeah, it goes in waves. Certainly, fintech has been stronger in previous years, I would say, with climate tech really pushing forward this year.
We touched a little bit on how the formation of capital has changed in the last decades, both in the number of people interested in technology that also have the capital to invest, but also you have the infrastructure available to make the pooling of capital easier. So I was wondering, how do you see the space, how do you see the crowdfunding space look like in, let's say, 10 years? Where do you see seeders in 10 years?
Great question. We, you know, in many ways, we have gotten to, I guess, mass adoption in the UK, and I would say on the founder side, right? So equity crowdfunding has become relatively mainstream. If you are a founder in UK, you have probably at least considered using seeders or a platform like us as part of your fundraising journey. And driving this is that sort of ecosystem piece I touched on, where, you know, venture capital funds are using us as well. But that is just a really, it's sort of a drop in the ocean still, isn't it? That's, you know, only in the UK. And, you know, on the investor side, I'd say we are still very early in the journey of raising awareness and education of investors about this asset class. It's equally, you know, we've just become authorized in Europe, and Europe is still, I would say, on both sides of that marketplace, still very early in the adoption of this model as a way of funding into growth companies. So we just became authorized a couple of weeks ago by the... Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a long journey to get authorized by the Central Bank of Ireland a few weeks ago, and just last week launched our European platform, which is, I think it was 6 years ago that they first started even talking about this piece of regulation that would be a unified EU regulation to cover crowdfunding. It came into operation 2 years ago. And we have been on that journey since to become authorised and launch. We're seeing huge demand for this kind of platform in the EU. I'm really excited about that opportunity, but there's still such a long way to go to raise awareness and do that education piece that we've been doing for so many years here in the UK.
And how do you guys go about raising the awareness, both, as you mentioned, on the founder side, but maybe they thought about it, they've heard about the potential or the ability to do it, but also on the investor side?
Yeah, it's certainly easier on the founder side, I would say. We know we're sort of plugged into that ecosystem now. We know the types of businesses we're looking for. We generally know where to find them. One of the nice things about crowdfunding is that community piece, in that the whole, you know, big aim is that a business that has a large community, we give them the tools to market their fundraise to that community. And then we provide the education piece, and we provide a great product and a great user experience that they want to use Seeders again. And they want to, you know, find other opportunities on the platform to then invest in. And so that's a very sort of, you know, natural path to creating new investor communities, and why we are so focused in Europe on certain jurisdictions rather than going sort of EU at all at once, really focusing in on certain countries so that we can create that community aspect within each of those countries. So we're very focused in Spain, the Netherlands, Sweden and Denmark, and want to make sure we're creating that ecosystem where the entrepreneurs can continue to benefit from investors on the platform that are looking for opportunities in that market.
Wonderful. I mean, we have a lot of listeners in Sweden and in Denmark. So if the founders listening to this episode, they want to give it a try, they should just give it a try.
Absolutely. And when I always say, you know, founders, people always ask me, where does the founder get started on this? You should really get started by investing, you know, and you know, that's a bit of a, sounds like it's a bit of a plug, but yeah, you know, it doesn't have to be a lot of money, but you should go through that journey and understand what it looks like to be an investor on one of these platforms. You know, look at other founders' pitches, think about, you know, look at their video, look at their discussion forum and the kind of questions they're getting, and look at it from that perspective through the whole journey, so that you can have, you know, how to reach out effectively when it comes to your time.
Exactly. Kirsty, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. Congratulations on the amazing job that you guys have done. You've been at it for so many years. I really think that this is a very important problem in the formation of capital. I think more founders should dare and build businesses, and more founders should use crowdfunding. Any departing thoughts to founders or investors listening?
No, but thank you so much for having me, and I'm feeling very old when you keep talking about how long we've been at this. It feels still very early in the Seeders journey, to be honest. But I completely agree that, you know, there should be more founders out there. We need more people starting businesses to solve all the problems that we're facing as a society. And if we can play a small part in leveling the playing field, I guess, in terms of how capital gets allocated to founders, and giving some power back to retail investors in that decision making as to where capital goes, then I'd be very proud of that.